Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. I have on the show with us today Dr. William Dembski, a well-known name to anyone who follows the Discovery Institute. Dr. Dembski is a senior fellow at Discovery Institute who holds both a PhD in mathematics and philosophy. He received his PhD in mathematics from the University of Chicago and his PhD in philosophy from the University of Illinois at Chicago. And he's done a lot of other work, including an MDiv, degrees in psychology, and he's now a professor at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. So Dr. Dembski, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Good to be back with you, Casey.
Well, our occasion for having you back on the Idea of the Future podcast is your recent publication of a peer-reviewed scientific article in the journal IEEE Transactions on Systems, Man, and Cybernetics A, Systems and Humans, which is a peer-reviewed scientific article titled Conservation of Information and Search, Measuring the Cost of Success, which supports many of your arguments regarding the conservation of information and the ability of Darwinian processes to create new information. And you co-authored this paper with Dr. Robert Marks, a distinguished professor at Baylor University, and I'd like to talk to you about this paper today, if you don't mind, Dr. Dembski.
That'd be great.
So let's first start off with the IEEE. That stands for the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. What can you tell us about that organization and the journal that they publish?
Well, the first thing is it's huge. It's the largest professional society in the world. I think it's got about 360,000 members. And they have all sorts of journals. I mean, it's I'm not sure about the exact number there, but this is one of many. It's appropriate for what we were publishing and finally got these ideas out. So it's a good venue. Lots of engineers out there. Engineers tend to be more favorably disposed toward intelligent design than biologists and many in the natural sciences. So it's, I think, a good place to get our ideas out.
So what does your paper show about the ability of Darwinian processes to generate new information?
I would say what the paper does is sets up an accounting procedure, shows us how to calculate the information that's being put into evolutionary processes. So by itself, I think that the paper is one of several that are coming out. There's another follow-up paper, which I think is really going to pound the nails in the coffin. So I don't think by itself this paper disproves Darwinian processes. What it does is it shows that Darwinian processes require information to work. I think that the real question then is that information self-generated or does it have to be put in from an outside source? Now, the case studies we do in the paper shows that it is being put in from an outside source. We have some powerful results that follow up on this paper. This is a paper called The Search for the Search, which is coming out, should be out now, but there have been some delays with the journal that's publishing that. That I think, will really nail things down. So what this paper does is it's giving us accounting practices for checking out where the information in these evolutionary processes is being put in and how it's being expressed. And this is important because it certainly is the case that evolutionary processes do better than blind search. Okay, I mean, there's no question. But insofar as they do better, it is because they have been given information. Especially when we represent this computationally, we can see where the information is going in and how it's being expressed, and we can measure this information in terms of performance. So what we do is we have these performance measures. The first thing is we always establish a baseline of what is the essential difficulty of the problem, how much information, as it were, is needed to find, these are always targeted searches, to find the target if we're just using blind search. And that's often going to be an immense amount of information because these searches tend to be needle in the haystack problems. And then we ask, well, how much better is the evolutionary search doing? And that will often, there won't be much information involved at all because as far as for the evolutionary search, the search is actually quite simple. The key measure is this difference between the improvement that we're getting with the evolutionary search and the difficulty in the original search. You have to quantify this in terms of these information measures. And when we do that, we get this notion of active information. And we decided to go with the term active information because it seems that that's exactly what is being put into these programs. Also, it has some precedent because John Polkinghorne, a physicist some years back, described active information as a way that actually God injects information into the world without disrupting natural forces. And so there's some connections, loose connections there. But anyway, there seemed to be some precedent for this term, and so we describe it that way. But as I said, I mean, the focus is on the accounting of this information, because it seems that often what happens in the evolutionary literature, especially when evolutionary models, computing models are used, there's a sense in which, well, isn't it amazing how this information just magically materialized? And the thing is, there seems to be a fundamental commitment on the part of people who hold to unguided evolution that information is just something you get out of the evolutionary process, that it's that evolution generates that information. And what we're arguing is that, no, it's not generated or created. It's shuffled around, and it has to be put there by an external source.
Well, Dr. Dembski, you are blowing right by many of the questions that I scripted out to ask you and answering them without me even asking them. So I want to ask you about something that you talked about in your 2001 book, No Free Lunch, where you talked about the idea of a no free lunch theorem. Can you explain to our listeners what is a no free lunch theorem, and is that the same as the conservation of information, and how do these concepts play out in your new paper?
Right. The no free lunch theorems go back a little bit over a decade, and what they assert is that really any search that you do, when you represent it mathematically, when you average the performance of that search over different targets or different criteria for success, that no search really does any better than any other search. So what we're talking about is a general search scheme, if you will. No one is doing better than any other when you start averaging. And so this raises a question because, you know, you think that, well, one possible search is blind search. And so in a sense, blind search is no worse or better than any other search. But the thing is, in practice, we do find that searches can be adapted to specific problems, and then they will do much better than blind search. So what is it that allows individual searches in given situations to do so much better? This is then where, in a sense, we key off of the no free lunch. No free lunch is a leveler. It says that basically all search algorithms, unless you have some problem-specific information, unless you know something specific about what you're looking for, no search procedure is going to be any better than any other. So given that some search procedures are better in practice, what makes the difference? And what we're arguing is that what makes the difference is, well, this active information. It's by putting active information into these searches that they end up performing, doing better than blind search or this basic baseline level of performance. And the thing is, this baseline level of performance is going to be inadequate in general. I mean, most of the searches that come up in computer science and certainly in biology are needle in the haystack problems. And so blind search isn't going to be able to do anything effective in finding these needles. And so what is going to allow us to do it? Well, it's going to be information. I think a way to illustrate what's at stake, because I think this is all going to sound pretty abstract, is imagine that you're searching for a treasure on an island. The treasure is underground. It's small. The island's very large. How are you going to find it? Well, that's a needle in a haystack. Just blind search, you know, just bumbling around the island randomly isn't going to do anything for you. So how are you going to find it? Well, one possibility is that it's like an Easter egg hunt. And so somebody is saying warmer, warm, colder, cold, hot, hot, you're boiling, something like that, as you're moving around the island. Well, that's giving you information, okay, about where that treasure is. And so it's going to take information to find that treasure. That information can be quantified. And this is then what we're doing, is we're looking for the sources of information and quantifying how much information is being put into these searches to make them successful. And let me say one more thing, because you asked me to connect this, no free lunch, with conservation of information. The notion of conservation of information, it comes from an insight in computer science, which really goes back even 50, 60 years. There was a computer scientist, Brioan, who basically says that the computing machine cannot create new information. It can really merely move around existing information. And, I mean, it's a notion which actually even goes back further in the sense that if you have the axioms for a mathematical theory, when you start proving the theorems, in a sense, all those theorems are already incipient or there in the axioms. So you're not getting anything fundamentally new. And so the idea with conservation of information is that when you see information expressed in some sort of unguided or computational process, so where there's no intelligence moving from outside and moving the pieces around, then the information that's being expressed had to be there already. So what happens when you see information expressed, at least as much information had to be there. Now, some people have objected that with conservation of information, strictly speaking, the information need not be conserved in the sense of being identical. When we use conservation of information, the idea is that when you backtrack in time, when you see information expressed, then the information that was put in had to be at least what you see outputted. I mean, and we have this sort of experience all the time. I mean, if you have a book or something, put it on the shelf 100 years later, you come back, there's going to be some degradation. I mean, some sort of entropic degradation. And so the information that was there in that book conveyed by the characters may not be as fully conveyed because a page or portions may be faded, and so you may not see what the original text was. So if you go back in time, when you see information expressed, when you go back in time, there is always at least as much information or more. And so that's what we mean by conservation of information, that when evolutionary processes, search algorithms, express information, at least that much information had to be there. How do they express it? They express it by successfully locating targets, because search is a search for a target. Now, a big objection that has been put to our work is that evolution is not a targeted search. You know, we're told over and over again that evolution is non-teleological. And we would say that there are two ways of understanding targets. One is as artificially imposed patterns where people are just, as it were, drawing a target on a wall, you know, or setting up a target as for an archer. But targets can also be given to us by nature. They're only certain ways to be alive. There are only certain ways for amino acid strings to form functional proteins. So those seem to be targets that they're functional patterns that are in nature. And when natural forces are said to find them, I think we may rightly ask, well, was there any information required for them to find those targets? And I think they could legitimately be called targets. But that's a big area of controversy right now with our work, because I think they want to say, well, there are really no targets. But it's not that just that we're bumbling through a biological configuration space and anything is as good as anything else. Biology is a study of biological structures that have function, you know, have particular biological functions. So anyway, that's been a point of controversy.
And Dr. Dembski, I mean, many of the simulations of evolution that you talk about in your paper behave certainly as if there are targets out there to be found, and they will actually pre-specify targets and claim that that somehow models biological reality, as if there are targets that need to be found through these searches. And this actually brings me to a question that I'm very interested in asking you. You write in your paper that, quote, problem-specific information is almost always embedded in search algorithms. Yet because this information can be so familiar, we can fail to notice its presence. So can you give us some examples of algorithms where people forgot that maybe their own simulations contained problem-specific information, and they were claiming that this modeled Darwinian evolution in a pure Darwinian sense, that there was no input of outside information, but yet there really was information inputted into their simulation? Are there any examples you can give us that maybe you talk about in your paper?
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty. I mean, I think perhaps the first one is called to mind is Richard Dawkins. He thinks it is like a weasel example in The Blind Watchmaker. He has in there a target phrase that he's searching for, and then he runs an evolutionary computation where basically he calculates a proximity to that target phrase, where as sequences of letters are varying, he's going to count the number of matches with the target phrase, and then lo and behold, this evolutionary process converges very quickly to the target phrase. Now he'll say, well, evolution isn't like that. It doesn't search for targets. So he's trying to illustrate what natural selection and variation of some sort. But the thing is, he does want to use it as a justification for evolution. And really, this example, in a nutshell, contains the same basic fallacy, if you will, as many of the more sophisticated programs. And I think this is one thing our theory does, is show that basically you can, there's the old P game where you put the P under 3 cups. Well, if you put them under 5 cups or 10 cups or whatever, you're still moving the P around and it's still a game. And the P is not magically materializing or dematerializing. It's still there. It still has to be accounted for. And so this information problem that we see in these other programs, it's the same issue that keeps coming up over and over again. And of course, when you're running computer simulations, you've got an objective. There's a target you're looking at. It's not just that you're throwing up random lines of code. I mean, these are formulated as searches where some things, you've got an error counting function, you've got a fitness or something that's determining what's better than what. And so in virtue of setting it up that way, you are inputting information. I don't know if it's so much that people are forgetting what they're doing. I think without having some clear accounting practices of what sort of how much information they're putting in, how much they're getting out, I think they just conduct their work as drunken sailors, spending information in this case instead of money, and they don't worry about it. Well, I think the intelligent design community is now holding them accountable. And all of these examples, I mean, when you press them and hold their feet to the fire, they'll admit that they've cooked it, that they've set this up so that you do have an evolutionary algorithm that converges more rapidly than a blind search, and it works because they've put in information. When people then want to deny that biological evolution faces the same challenge, that biological evolution is untargeted, I think they put themselves, the evolutionists, in a difficult position, because if evolution is untargeted and if the computer simulations are targeted, then the computer simulations tell us nothing about biological evolution. And yet they do want to say that it tells us something. I mean, when Rob Pennock and Richard Lenski write a Nature article in 2003 with the program Avida, they don't mention Michael Behe or irreducible complexity in the article, but when Robert Pennock testifies before the Dover case about this program, he says that it refutes Behe's notion of irreducible complexity and that it is relevant to intelligent design and that it supports Darwinian evolution. Well, how can that be? If evolution is an untargeted search and this is a targeted search, the Avida program is a targeted search, then there's a disconnect, and it shouldn't. So they do want to say that. But if it does model what's going on in biology, if these evolutionary searches model what's going on in biology, then they're targeted. And then our whole apparatus flies. So I think they're in a catch-22. If they want to say that what we're finding with computer simulations doesn't apply, then basically evolution is a non-exact science. There's no mathematical models for it. It's just spinning in the wind. So I think they're in a difficult position, which is fine with me.
Well, Dr. Dembski, I think that we're running out of time for this first podcast, but our listeners, if they want to read your paper published in the journal IEEE Transactions on Systems, Man, and Cybernetics, titled Conservation of Information and Search, Measuring the Cost of Success, they can actually go to your website, evoinfo.org, to download the PDF of this article. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. We'll have more with Dr. William Dembski on his peer-reviewed paper, Conservation of Information in Search, Measuring the Cost of Success, coming up in a second podcast. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.